Thank you. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our morning workshop entitled All Camps, World War II, Japanese American Historical Sites Workshop. We have a very exciting panel for you to listen today. And what I wanted to do is to first, because this is a workshop to talk about the work and the efforts made at all of the confinement sites, we wanted to leave time at the end of our discussion to hear about the updates and the status and summary from all of the representatives who are here representing various confinement sites. So what I've done is I have this piece of paper, and if you could please sign your name and indicate the confinement site that you are representing, we would like to ask you to come up at the end of our workshop and just share with us where you are, what your efforts are, and what the plans are for the immediate future. And if I could ask Amy to pass that around, and if you could give that back up to me so we can know exactly how much time we would delegate to each of the camps. Before I introduce our panelists today, we have three distinguished panelists, I wanted to provide you with a brief overview of just how far our community has progressed over the past 20 years in terms of being able to share the Japanese American experience with the general public. And I'm sure that all of you know that this year, actually next month, marks the 20th anniversary of the signing of H.R. 442, the Civil Liberties Act of 1988. And at that time, it was really a great victory and something that many thought wouldn't happen. And unfortunately, many of those people who were the leaders and the actual recipients of the monetary compensation have left us today. But I think that, I think that we really need to stop, especially next month, and do some reflection and really thank all of those people who have come before us and who have served as our leaders. To thank them for the efforts of getting the redress bill passed and to allow us to progress to where we are today, because I think some really remarkable things have happened over the past 20 years. Shortly after the passage of H.R. 442, it included a provision that a public education program be instituted, and that public education program is known as the Civil Liberties Public Education Fund. And that fund allocated about $5 million to individuals, organizations, and other institutions across the United States to educate people about what happened to Japanese Americans during World War II. And then 10 years after that, in this state called California, there was a guy named Mike Honda who decided that we needed to create our own legislation. We needed to create our own legislation because over two-thirds of those who were incarcerated during World War II were from the state of California. So we were fortunate to have a Republican governor who signed a piece of legislation and authorized $1 million to be appropriated to this specific fund called the California Civil Liberties Public Education Program. And I'm happy to report to you, even though we suffer a $15 billion deficit in the state, that the program still survives today. It has been reduced to $500,000, but it still has its original intention of providing funds to individuals, organizations, and others who are interested in providing us with some aspect of the story of the Japanese American experience during World War II. But as we were administering the program in the state of California, we began to see that there were some aspects of the program that didn't allow us to really have a statewide effect. And therefore, in the year 2002, we had our first what we call an all-camp summit in San Francisco, where we asked people, various representatives from a number of the different camps, to come together and to share with us some of their challenges, some of their accomplishments, some of their goals and dreams about what they wanted to see for their particular confinement sites. And then 2 years after that, we met again in the state of Arkansas. Not too many Japanese in the state of Arkansas, but we met there in 2004, and it was at that time that we had this guy named Gerald Yamada come up and tell us about this idea that he had about figuring out some way that we could introduce a piece of federal legislation to see how we can get funding and recognition for all the confinement sites across the nation. And here we are 4 years later, and Gerald really single-handedly has accomplished a miracle, another miracle, and that is the passage of a piece of legislation that will finally allow us to show some national recognition to the confinement sites. And now we're in the process of actually seeing some funding diverted to these sites. And we'll hear those carrots speak about that later. And then finally, because the speakers have much more interesting things to say than I do, I wanted to, I was asked at the end of this session to talk a little bit about fundraising tips. I have to admit to you that I am not a fundraiser. I have read a few grants in my lifetime, some as small as $500 and some as large as $5 million. And the one thing I could say is that the best proposals are those that are written from the heart. Of course, technical expertise is always helpful to do your final check, but those who truly are passionate about their project really come through to the grant reader. And I will be more than happy to talk to you about some of the things that I have observed through these 10 years of grant reading. But I'd like to right now take the time to introduce our panelists and let you know what will be happening for the next hour, 2 hours and 45 minutes. We have three speakers, and I will introduce them in alphabetical order. The three speakers will have 20 minutes each to make their presentation. And then upon conclusion of the last speaker, we're going to have a break. And then when we come back from the break, we're going to ask those individuals who have signed up on that sheet that's going around to provide us with a very brief, and if I could ask you to be concise, summary about what's happening at your particular confinement site. I'm asking you to be brief because we want to make sure that we have enough time and opportunity to hear all of the representatives and then leave time at the end of our session to have question and answers. So the first a speaker that I would like to introduce is Amy Cole. Amy is an all-around multi-purpose person today. She brought in our projector and brought in our fancy projector. She is the Senior Program Officer and Regional Attorney for the Mountain Plains Office of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. The Trust has been a great friend to the Asian Pacific American community in general. They were the really, they are one of the leaders in historic preservation, and they have embraced several of us who have been attending their national conference to have our own Asian Pacific American historic preservation conference, and that will happen for the first time this year, right? And hopefully we will see some of you in Tulsa, Oklahoma in October. October. Our next speaker is Kara Miyagishima, and she is a historian with the Intermountain Region of the National Park Service, and Kara will later on be talking about the program in particular and maybe about just a brief overview of what the National Park Service does and represents in terms of national historic landmarks and national monuments. And then finally, we have Gerald Yamada, an attorney who is also a partner at the law firm of O'Connor and Harmon. So if I could ask Gerald to start our presentation today, and he will talk about the efforts, his personal efforts to enact Public Law 109441, the preservation of Japanese American World War II confinement sites.
Thank you, Diane. Morning. The what I want to cover in the next 20 minutes is an overview of why we went forward with this legislation, what the legislation does, the current status of funding for the legislation, and where we hope to go in the future. The law was signed into legislation was signed into law on December 21, 2006. And so it creates an ongoing program. Next slide. The legislation was sponsored by the Japanese American National Heritage Coalition. This is basically an ad hoc coalition that I organized to basically communicate to the Congress that the support for the legislation was across all the state or across the United States. It had broad community-based support, and that it was bipartisan. And today we have 33 organizations that have signed up as members. Organizations are still signing up. I think within the last 6 months, two additional organizations signed on. And again, it's helpful to have that type of coalition, because when you're talking to the Congress, it's important to be able to communicate that what you're asking for isn't for a particular organization, a particular site, or particular company. That there's interest, broad interest in it, and it has community support. And that, I think, has been very, very effective. I mean, we have supporters on the Hill that would support it even if it were for one site. But I think in terms of bringing on additional co-sponsors, and on the House side, we were able to get 114 co-sponsors. And again, I think it's because of the community support that we were able to articulate. Now, the question is, why did we create this legislation? Why did we ask for this legislation? And I think it really focuses on two words. And the two words are heritage and legacy. And for those of us that were in the internment camps or associated with the experiences during World War II, I think we have a responsibility to define our legacy and to shape that legacy and to preserve that legacy. It's not a matter, I think we do a injustice to our children and to future generations in terms of those who went through the camp experience, have some memory of the camp experience, if they don't help to preserve that legacy and leave it for future generations. I was born in Jerome, Arkansas. I'm a camp baby, and I have absolutely no memory of camp. So from preserving the legacy perspective, if you gave me a piece of paper and say, write down what you remember, I'll have to hand you back a blank piece of paper. But for those that do have memories, I mean, those they're an important resource, and unfortunately, we're losing that resource at a very rapid rate. So time is, I felt, somewhat critical in moving forward. And again, I really feel very strongly that it's our legacy. We need to decide how that legacy should be shaped, defined, and preserved. And if you leave it to other people to do, if you leave it to our future generations to do, then it'll be lost. And so the window of opportunity is now. And if we don't capture that opportunity, then again, let me just say it will be lost. The legislation, the heart of the legislation creates a federal grant program. It's to be funded at $38 million. And as all statutes, it defines the types of activities that the monies can be used for. In drafting the legislation, I attempted to cast as wide a net as I could in terms of defining the activities, in terms of what would what could be funded. And again, the idea was not so much that the legislation would drive what would be done at the confinement sites, but it provides the resources for people to be creative and to think about how they want to preserve their legacy. I mean, if we wanted to mandate a certain approach, we would ask Manzanar for their blueprints for the interpretive center, make 9 additional copies and send it to each of the camps and committees and say, this is what would be done. And to me, that just didn't make sense. I mean, I give a lot of credit to what has happened at Manzanar, but that's not necessarily what should be done at each of the other sites. And, you know, again, it's the people at the grassroots level, the community, the committees, that really need to think through what they want to do and how they want to communicate their message. And the legislation hopefully provides 2 tools for you. One, it provides funding. And the second, it creates a partnership, hopefully with the National Park Service, to work with you to help preserve that legacy. There are 2 provisions in the statute which I want to emphasize. One thing we really attempted to preserve in the legislation is transparency and public participation. We wanted, in realizing what the various options as to who should give out the grants, you know, how we should structure the funding, to me it made the best sense to work with the National Park Service. But in doing that, I was with the Environmental Protection Agency for 18 years and was Deputy General Counsel for 13 of the 18. So I have a pretty good insight as to how federal agencies work and don't work. And so the one thing that I wanted in the legislation is community or public participation. And we tried to build that in to the program. And I think the signal so far, at least from the National Park Service, is that they are trying to have an open door and work with the community in terms of working with us. But again, that has its foundation in the legislation. The second provision, which I must say I'm relatively proud of, is a very unique provision. Federal laws, as a general rule, sunset in 5 years. So if you have a federal law that you, a federal program that you create, and it's never funded for 5 years, the legislation dies and the program goes away. And the one unknown when was going through this process is to what extent we could get funding for the program. So the sunset provision that's in the statute provides that the law expires 2 years after the last grant is made, after the program is fully funded. In other words, Congress has to appropriate the full $38 million before the law dies. So this law will be on the books, could be on the books, for a fairly lengthy period of time, but definitely beyond the normal 5-year period. Let me talk a little bit about the grant requirements. First of all, you must be a eligible applicant, and I'll get into that in a minute. The statute provides for a 2-to-1 federal match. In other words, the federal government gives you $2, for every dollar, private dollar that you're able to raise. The match can be either what we call hard match or in-kind match. Hard match is cash, which you have in the checking account. The in-kind match is if you're donating land, if you're donating services, can all be considered to be in-kind match. Now, there are definite rules that are federal regulations and guidelines that define what is considered to be in-kind match. So that if you're going to generate or use in-kind match, then you need to work with the National Park Service to make sure that what you are generating is right. The final provision is that after money is made available by Congress, the National Park Service is required to make grants within 180 days. That's a provision that's somewhat of a hammer provision. In the environmental statutes, at least for federal regulations, there are hammer provisions. And what this provision does from strictly a legal standpoint is that it changes the ability to make grants from a discretionary decision to a mandatory decision. And the effect of that is if an applicant wanted to bring a litigation to enforce that mandatory duty, the provision would, I think, provide that authority. Next slide. In terms of definitions, there are three definitions that I want to focus on. First of all, let me say the law isn't real long. I think it's like a little over two pages. But it does have some key definitions. One is who can be a grant application. The grant application definitions for applicants is pretty broad, and it basically has the general language, except for one exception, which I want to get into. It talks about state, local, tribal governments, education institutions, and nonprofit organizations as being eligible. Now, the one provision that, in terms of the definition, I wanted to make sure that we preserve the eligibility for tribal governments. And the reason for that is two of the sites are on tribal lands. And I represent the St. Croix Indian Tribe of Wisconsin. So I'm very sensitive to some of the Indian issues and Indian relation issues. And so in working through the legislation, wanted to make sure that we didn't offend or obstruct the relationship between tribal governments and the federal governments, the federal government. As I mentioned earlier, one of the items that we were very interested in preserving was public consultation. And the Senate committee modified that, and in so modifying it, it required that consultation also be included with organizations involving the preservation of historic confinement sites. And they built that into the definition or into the grant-making authority provision. And the way I read the provision is that it expanded the class of applicants. And the reason for that is the Senate report lists all the, what the Senate report refers to organizations involved in the preservation of confinement sites, and they list the organizations. And what they did was they listed the Japanese American National Heritage Coalition and then proceeded to list all the member organizations. And at that time, we had 30 organizations. And what that did is it made all the organizations, including the Heritage Coalition, eligible to apply for grants. So that means the National Japanese American National Museum, JCL, the Heritage Coalition, are all eligible applicants. And they are, it's my understanding that those organizations are looking at this legislation with a view toward making that grant application. So that was an interesting twist. That wasn't something that I was advocating as we went through the authorizing process, but it's something that the Senate did. And there's a reason for why that was done, but that's if people want to talk to me about it afterwards, I can discuss that. But the effect of it is I think it broadened the class of applicants beyond what was contemplated, at least when I drafted the legislation. The confinement sites term is basically a term that I coined. And if you go look at the redress, the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, and all the other legislation that talks about the Japanese World War II experience, it talks about the 10 internment camp sites. And my concern with that is that it shortens the definition or the scope of eligible applicants, because my sense was that there are other stories that need to be told. And I've been working very closely with the Hunaluiluiconfinement site. As a matter of fact, I met with them last week when I was in Hawaii about telling their story. It's surprising that even Japanese Americans that live in Hawaii don't know what happened to Japanese Americans right after Pearl Harbor, that there were 5 confinement sites in Hawaii, and that initially about 5,000 Japanese Americans or persons of Japanese ancestry were confined, and about 2,500 were shipped to the United States when the 10 internment camps were closed. But anyway, what I wanted to do is make sure we broaden the definition. And so what the statute does, it ties the term confinement site to a 1999 publication that talks about the over 50 sites that were used to confine Japanese Americans. Let me, since my time is is limited, let me just talk very briefly about where we are on funding the legislation. In order to operate a federal program, you need 2 statutes. You need an authorizing statute, and that's what we were able to pass. It passed. The other law that you need is an Appropriations Act, and that's an annual ordeal that you go through. And the appropriations process is very different than the authorizing process. But next slide. Let's talk about where we are now. The main barrier that we face is the president did not include funding for this program in the 2009 budget. And the reason for that, at least the reason I've been told, is that the National Park Service, as well as most domestic programs, don't want to fund new programs. What they want to do is try to increase funding or preserve existing programs. So the president did not include monies for this program. There is a window of opportunity that members of Congress are given in about the March-April timeframe. And the appropriations process, which is a very closed, confidential process, they open the window. The chairman of the Appropriation Committee opens the window and asks other members of Congress if they have pet projects or priorities that they want funded. We were able to get 22 members to sign onto a letter to the House Committee Chair asking for $5 million for this program. And it's my understanding that the subcommittee has included $1.5 million for this program. Now, the full committee was supposed to go to markup at the end of June. That was postponed, and that will take place next week. The difficulty that the House is having, and this is particularly with the interior bill, is that it's got caught up in the concern about rising gas prices and offshore drilling. So it's become a very political, a very sensitive bill. It has absolutely nothing to do with this program, but it's something that we're unfortunately caught up for. Senator Inouye has asked for money for the program on the Senate side, but the Senate has not had markup yet, so I don't know to what extent that will be, how much will be included on the Senate side. I firmly believe if the House passes the 1.5, we will, or includes the 1.5, the Senate will at least start with the 1.5 and hopefully go up to whatever the senator has asked for us. Diane, how much more time do I have? Or am I out of time? Okay. Well, I've got some additional comments, but maybe I can pick that up during the question and answer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gerald. Okay. I'd next like to introduce Amy Cole. Right, is it Amy? Is it? Okay. And maybe we could switch.
Yeah, can you? That'd be great.
And as I mentioned before, Amy is an attorney with the Mountain Plains office here in Denver of the National Trust for Historic Preservation.
So I think I have to speak into the mic because of the recording thing. So one thing I just want to hand out before I start, Diane mentioned that, and Carol will be my assistant. Diane mentioned that we at the National Trust have done a sort of broader Asian Pacific program, and the handout that is coming around is from our office in California that sort of describes a number of the projects that they have been working on. And I work in the Mountains Plains office, which covers 8 states, and the internment camps that are in my region are Topaz and Amachi and Heart Mountain. And then our office in California has also done work with the camps that are in their region, and no one is here from our office because the person who's now working on those issues for us delivered twins about 2 weeks ago, so she's very busy doing mom tasks. And so I'm going to talk about some of the things that our office in California has done, but I don't have the personal information that Elaine Stiles could offer about some of those things. So if you have more questions about that, we can put you in touch with our California folks. So, okay. So yesterday I was on the bus number 4 that went out to Amachi, which was a very good trip, and we were happy to be out there on a day when it was not 110 degrees, which it's probably going to be on Saturday for those of you headed out there then. Okay, next slide. So my organization is a national, a national nonprofit. We were founded in the 1940s by Congress, chartered by Congress like the Red Cross is. We don't receive federal money any longer. We are now strictly, completely nonprofit and do fundraising to meet our budget every year. We are a membership organization, and we have about 200 and some thousand members. And as I said, my office is one of a number of regional offices that we have, and we cover the Mountains and Plains states. Next. So our mission is to provide leadership, education, advocacy, and resources, basically to save historic places. And so most of the work that we have done with internment camp sites are related to those three goals. And here is a breakdown of how our regions are organized. And Kara, who's going to speak next, is from a regional office of the Park Service. And of course, none of their regions are the same boundaries as our regions. So Kara and I work on some things in our neck of the woods and then also with the office in California. Next. One of the things that Diane asked us to talk about a little bit is who does what. And this chart is designed to just give you a not exhaustive overview, but a brief look at how the public sector activities and the private sector activities kind of break down, with the Park Service and the Department of Interior being the main federal agency, and many of the programs that the Park Service carries out are implemented in the states through a program called the State Historic Preservation Offices. And those are good partners for all historic preservation activities. And then at a local level, probably this is not so applicable to campsites, but to other sites, there are other types of local designation of historic places, such as a local landmark or a local historic district. And those are usually the function of zoning in your community. On the private sector side, the National Trust is the primary national organization that does historic preservation advocacy. And then there are many statewide preservation organizations as well. Almost every state has a state preservation group. In Utah, for example, it's the Utah Heritage Foundation. Here in Colorado, it's Colorado Preservation. There, California is the California Preservation Foundation. So those are also good partners for folks working on site preservation. And for example, the Colorado statewide group has an endangered places list. And a few years ago, Amachi was on their endangered places list because of the threat of some development at the site, which is now gone away. So they have then provided help to the folks at Amachi with advocacy and grants and things of that sort. And then last of all, on the private sector side, there are certainly many local groups that are historic preservation or historical society type of organizations. Like in Denver, we have Historic Denver, for example. And there are also a lot of groups that are related to Main Street, sort of commercial development and economic development in small communities. So these are just a few slides that highlight kind of what my organization does. We started the National Main Street Program about 25 years ago as a way to try to help small towns that were struggling with abandonment of downtowns and, you know, relocation to the mall and things of this sort. And there are now about 3,000 Main Street communities in local places all over the country. We also operate a number of historic sites, and we have most of those on the East Coast, but there is one, the one that's in the lower left corner if you're out here in Colorado for a while and you happen to make it up to Georgetown. That is the Hotel de Paris Museum, which is, we think, the only historic site that is interpreted as a hotel, and which is, of course, what it was. And it was founded by a person who sort of remade himself after he arrived in Colorado, as lots of pioneers did. And it is a mining town that's a little bit west of Denver on I-70. So if you get out of town and you want to check that out, that's the one historic site that the National Trust operates in our region. Next. And saving historic places is pretty much the crux of what we are all about, and just wanted to put in a few different pictures in here of other types of sites that my office and the National Trust is involved in. Amachi has been a place where we have been involved for a number of years with the Optimists and the Park Service, and John Hopper's students at the Amachi Preservation Society. We also do work with public lands. The Chimney Rock Pueblo is a Forest Service site here in Colorado where we have been working for a few years. And the recent past is something that has gotten a lot of attention lately, in the property that is Beaver Meadows is in Rocky Mountain National Park, which was designed by Taliesin West Architects as part of the Park Service's Mission 66 program. Next. So what another thing that Diane asked us to talk about is what exactly can we do for you? So this is basically organized around education, advocacy, and resources, which are the three types of services that we provide. So just a few highlights of things in the education realm. We have participated in all of the All Camp summits that have gone on over the past few years, and then also tried to integrate some sessions into our National Preservation Conference, which this last year was held in the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and Tom and Kara and others came and did a session about the public law that Gerald just discussed, and we had a great turnout for that. And then we're doing a similar session again this year in Tulsa, and then also having an affinity session for Asian Pacific preservation issues generally. We also do stories and have several publications, and what you see here is a story about the Seattle basement where a number of internee trunks, suitcases, personal belongings, etc. were left when folks went off to camp. And we also have done other stories in our professional publications and in our magazine, which is called Preservation. So advocacy is a large part of what we do, and that is one way that also we can be different from other federal agencies, is that it's not always federal agencies' jobs to be advocates for historic sites. Sometimes it is, sometimes not so. And we do spend a lot of time on trying to help other folks who are working very hard to save historic places. Tom, can you click the next? So we have a program that is similar to the one that Colorado Preservation has, which I mentioned was in an endangered places list. And ours is called the 11 Most Endangered Historic Places. And last year, Minidoka was on that list, which was listed because the county was planning to approve a CAFO, in essence a feedlot, to go about a mile away from Minidoka, which is bad on a number of fronts, including ruining the visitor experience because of smell. And if you were on the Amachi bus as we were leaving, we were outside Lamar yesterday, and several people around us were going, "What is the smell?" That was the gigantic feedlot, and lots of people noticed it, and that's basically what would be right next door to Minidoka. So, And actually, just as an aside, CAFOs are a big issue right now, and they affect all sorts of things. And there are in Allenwood in California, which is a state park, there was one proposed near there. There's another one proposed near a couple of state parks in Missouri. And the regulation of CAFOs is a big concern. So this is something that for us is both a problem at Minidoka, and it's something that we can use to illustrate something that is more of a national problem as well. So Elaine Stiles, my colleague from our office in California, has been the primary contact person for Minidoka, and we have given them some money to look at a CAFO study and to try to determine what sort of effects there are, and you know, how do you quantify a bad smell and things like that. So next slide. Jane Beckwith, who is from Topaz and sitting here in the front row, a sort of unusual advocacy thing that we did a few years ago was help to support BLM's decision to not approve a telescopic array, which, for those of you that wonder what that is, in a big open desert area, you put out a bunch of transmitter, or I guess receivers, to receive information from the sky, right? So if we're not communicating with aliens, I suppose, but communicating with satellites and this sort of thing, and taking in information. And so they were planning BLM to approve this gigantic array, which was miles square, that would have been very close to Topaz. So you would have looked out towards the lovely mountain and seen nothing but collectors, these, you know, huge panels, it's sort of like a solar panel field next to Topaz. So we didn't completely succeed in, obviously that's going ahead as far as I know, but maybe not quite so close. Right. So they're not going to be so close. And of course, that came as a big surprise, I think, to BLM. They were sort of shocked that someone thought that this was not a good idea, and they weren't really that aware of the fact that Topaz was an important place. So we tried to help Jane make that point. And we have also helped to support the designation of NHLs, National Historic Landmarks, at some of the other campsites. And something else that the National Trust does generally is help provide organizational development assistance to groups of all sorts. And so things like strategic planning and fundraising assistance, if you want to hire somebody to help your board figure out how to work more effectively, we can help do that sort of thing too. So we do not have the sort of large-scale grants that come from the Park Service or from some of the great programs in California, but we have been able to give about $60,000 to a number of grassroots projects. I was trying to figure this out before I came. I don't believe we've given money to every single camp, but we have given money to most all of the camps and some of the other facilities like Hanauliuli that Gerald mentioned. Again, in sort of the advocacy resources, helping with surveys of historic sites, helping to do building assessments at Heart Mountain. We spent some funding to try to convince the Bureau of Reclamation, which owns the buildings there, that they were worth saving and how much that would cost. And then, again, organizational development type grant funds as well. And last of all, funding for things like this conference and other past all-camp summits. And also, as Diane mentioned, we've been in the past fortunate to have a number of folks come to our National Trust Conference, and we have some scholarship programs for that sort of thing, too, for folks that might want to come and learn about the bigger historic preservation movement and get to meet other folks working on similar projects and share what you're doing with them. So, you know, more or less, if you're interested in our help, and I have gotten to know a lot of you and the great work that you're doing in the 8 years I've been at this job, but there's always new projects and new faces, so the best way to figure out how we can help you is to talk to me or talk to Elaine in our office in the West, and we can talk to you about grants or help that we can give you for our project. And, as Diane said, I'm a lawyer, so a lot of what I do is administrative nastygram letter writing to agencies like the EPA and BLM and a lot of other folks. So we also have a pretty decent amount of sophistication with legal issues, and this is the CAFO. We're getting some help from our legal department on the CAFO issue. So we have folks in Washington that help us out as well. That's our headquarters staff. And just think about contacting us and letting us know how we might help you out. And there's how to get me, and I can help you figure out how to reach Elaine after she comes back from maternity leave. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Amy. And since she has 3 minutes left on her time, I just wanted to encourage all of you, if you have never been to a National Trust for Historic Preservation Conference, to attend. Tulsa, Oklahoma is probably not high on your places to visit, but I've been to several of them, and all of them have been in locations where I probably would never visit but for these conferences. And you really come away learning a lot. You come away learning a lot about what you don't know, and coming away with a true appreciation as to what local communities have done to preserve what they feel is important. And I think at least for me, before I understood what preservation means, and I really still don't, but when you talk about preservation or when you talk about preservation organizations, everyone thinks about the picture in the newspaper where someone's standing in front of the bulldozer right before a building is going to be demolished, or something like the Stanford Mansion that we have in Sacramento, California. Very pretty types of buildings. Very pretty buildings owned by very rich white people. And that is usually the general image that people have of preservation, but preservation has gone a lot further than that, and the National Trust has really helped to kind of shatter that image of what you should think about when you talk about preservation. And by working and talking with other folks at the National Trust Conference, you really, really begin to appreciate the work that they've done. And it's taken a long time, but the work that they've done and the work yet to be done. And then another thing that Amy mentioned are the grants that the National Trust gives. We call them in California planning grants. These are grants that help people to start to think about how to plan for their project, for their larger capital project. And what we believe is that a good plan will create a good project. And so planning grants are extremely important to us and usually are favored by funders who fund larger capital projects because it shows that you've done your homework. And there are not too many organizations that will allow you to apply for just a planning grant. And if there are, it's very narrow. It's only regarding the physical site. But the National Trust really allows you to take the planning grant to a much broader definition. So you could think about who you want on your staff, who you want on your board, how you want to conduct your fundraising campaign, and how long you want your project to last. So I strongly encourage all of you, if you haven't been on the National Trust website, to do so. So I've used up Amy's 3 minutes, and I'd like to introduce our next speaker. Our next speaker is from the National Park Service, and I'm sure that all of you, particularly those who are considered eligible, as Gerald defined, for these grants, are interested in hearing. And so without further delay, Kara.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for coming to our session. It's nice to see a lot of familiar faces and new faces out there. My name is Kara Miyagishima. I work with the Intermountain Region of the National Park Service. And our agency was established as a bureau within the Department of the Interior in 1916. And I think over time, our mission has pretty much stayed the same in that our goal is to work in partnership with others to preserve both the natural and cultural resources for present and future generations. I think it has expanded to include not only sites within the United States, but also abroad. And it also has grown to be much more inclusive of our diverse history as a nation. So there are almost 400 units of the National Park Service in the United States and U.S. territories that fall within seven different regions. My position is with the Intermountain Region, and we work with states starting with Montana, working your way down to, south to Texas. And so my role with the National Park Service thus far has really been to provide technical assistance to some of the sites that fall within our region, such as Heart Mountain in Wyoming, Topaz in Utah, Amachi here in Colorado, and both of the sites in Arizona, Poston and Gila River. So two of our National Park Service units include Manzanar, which was authorized by Congress as a National Historic Site in 1991 and became a unit of the Park Service, which means that it is owned and operated by our agency. And also the Minidoka National Historic Monument, which was authorized by Congress in 2001 and is now administered by the superintendent of Hagerman Fossil Beds National Monument. So there, most recently, legislation has been introduced to authorize a special resource study for Tule Lake to be evaluated through the special resource process as a possible unit of the National Park Service. And so this study basically would evaluate the significance, suitability, and feasibility for inclusion in the National Park Service, and that would also include a public component as well. So in addition to our park units, the National Park Service also works with various entities outside of our park system boundaries to recognize, preserve, and interpret historic resources and properties that are significant on a local, state, or national level. And so we have two main programs for this type of recognition. The first is through the National Register of Historic Places, which is part of a national program to coordinate both public and private efforts to identify, evaluate, and protect our historic and cultural resources. So the majority of these sites are locally significant and are designated by a state review board. And there are more than 80,000 properties listed on the National Register. So in comparison, the National Park Service also administers the National Historic Landmarks Program, which identifies the nation's most exceptional historic places. So currently there are fewer than 2,500 historic places that bear this national distinction. So this number may also seem high, but when you compare it to the number of properties listed on the National Register, which are 80,000 properties, there is a difference in terms of their designation. Typically, the National Register properties are locally significant, while National Historic Landmarks are properties that are significant on a national level, and they're also designated by the Secretary of the Interior. And one of the National Park Service strongly believes that one of the first steps in preserving these historic sites, such as these confinement sites, is recognition through our National Historic Landmarks program. So once a property is designated at NHL, there's usually extensive coverage by the media, which really generates a lot of attention by the public and increased appreciation for these historic places. With this comes the opportunity to partner with individuals, communities, other organizations to fundraise for the NHL, and this all works towards the preservation, long-term preservation of these sites. One of the ways that we identify potential National Historic Landmark sites is through a theme study. In February of 2005, Congress requested that the Secretary of the Interior prepare a report to identify, evaluate, and nominate key sites related to the evacuation, relocation, and internment of Japanese Americans in World War II. And this led to both the publication of Confinement and Ethnicity, which you all may be familiar with, and also the preparation of the Japanese Americans in World War II theme study. The theme study recommended designation of some of the confinement sites as potential National Historic Landmarks. And thus far, the Secretary of the Interior has designated the Ruhr Cemetery in Arkansas and the Amachi, Heart Mountain, Minidoka, Topaz, and Tule Lake sites as National Historic Landmarks. Other confinement sites that are on the National Register of Historic Places include the Fort Missoula Internment Center and the Moab Isolation Center, which is in Utah. So once the site is designated as a National Historic Landmark, this opens up several different opportunities for the partner to work with the National Park Service, either through cooperative agreement and also to apply for different National Park Service grants, which include the Challenge Cost Share Grant Program, Save America's Treasures, and also through our program, the Heritage Partnerships Program. Through the Challenge Cost Share Program, the types of projects that you would apply for relate to the preservation and interpretation. Those are those type of projects. The maximum grant request would be $30,000. It does require a match, but it can be a mix of both in-kind and cash. Recent projects that we've worked on with the confinement sites through this program include, I don't know how many of you were able to go to Amachi yesterday, but we partnered with the town and other friends groups to design and construct an interpretive kiosk at the entrance of the site, which was funded through this program. And also, a few years ago, we worked with the Conservation Fund to help them acquire additional land for the Topaz Museum to help protect that site further. We also administer the Save America's Treasures Grant, and this funding would go towards projects related to the preservation and conservation work. It is limited in terms of the types of projects that you can apply for. For example, you cannot acquire land under this program. There's no funding of reconstruction, moving buildings, or new construction projects. I think the range is approximately from $25,000 to $700,000, so it is a larger grant. It does require a dollar-for-dollar federal match, or non-federal match, excuse me, and that can be a combination of cash, donated services, things like that. One of the most recent projects that we funded through this program is in 2006, the Tule Lake. They received funding to stabilize their carpenter shop and correct some drainage problems at the site. And there is also another program that we administer, which is called the Preserve America Grant. And this grant is also for preservation and interpretive work, but focuses more on encouraging heritage tourism in these areas. The program that I work for out of the Lakewood office here in Colorado is called the Heritage Partnerships Program, and we also offer grants, but they're much smaller. So they're maybe like $10,000 maximum. And the only restriction with our grants is that they cannot be used for construction. They're mainly used for planning and design, things like that. We worked with, as Amy mentioned earlier, we partnered with the National Trust, Bureau of Reclamation, Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation to prepare a condition assessment for the buildings that are still have survived and are in the hospital complex of the site. We also helped prepare a National Historic Landmark nomination for Topaz. And once again, if you were at the Machi site yesterday, we also helped provide funding for an archaeological field study that they or field school that they have right now. That's being done by University of Denver archaeology students. And they also help the Machi Preservation Society. They have a small museum in town. And so then moving on to the new grant program that that Gerald explained, you know, his role in really creating that legislation and pushing it through. This program will also be administered by the National Park Service, and this will go specifically towards the preservation and interpretation of the confinement sites where Japanese Americans were detained during World War II. And I think that this program is unique because eligible projects as defined in the legislation include identification, research, evaluation, interpretation, protection, restoration, repair, and acquisition, although acquisition is limited to Topaz, Roer, Jerome, and Hanauliuli, some of which these type of projects are not eligible through some of our other National Park Service grants. And so I think that will really provide some new opportunities that have not been available in the past. So in June of 2007, the Appropriations Committee directed the National Park Service to prepare a report on how we would implement the grant program. In order to fulfill this request and following the key provisions of the law, one of which is it requires the Secretary of the Interior to consult with various entities before developing criteria for making grants, the National Park Service initiated a six-month communication strategy to gain valuable public input and to assist in the development of this grant program. And so basically we worked, there were mainly three different regions involved in this public in participation process and the development of the grant program, and also two different offices. One, the main regions that we're working on are the Intermountain region, Pacific West region, Midwest region, and then we also have contacts in Hawaii and in Washington, D.C. And so I'd also like to introduce at this time, we have Tom Leatherman, who is a superintendent at Manzanar National Historic Site, from the Pacific West region, and we have Rachel Franklin Weekly, who's from the Midwest region, who's also very key in conducting this public participation process. So basically, we began in August by mailing out more than 12,000 newsletters and hosting 20 public listening sessions across the nation. We had one here, a few here in Denver, one in Salt Lake City, listening sessions on the West Coast, in Hawaii, and in Chicago, to gather input on the following three key questions. So the basic questions that we were asking people are, you know, what are your hopes and expectations for this grant program? What type of projects do you think should receive funding through this program? And what should be the evaluation criteria for determining which proposals receive consideration for funding when it is available through the grant program? Altogether, we had more than 10,000 people participate in these listening sessions and provide comment on the grant program. That was done either by mailing in a comment card or going to a website that we established specifically for this program. I think some of the main key themes that emerged from these listening sessions and from the other input that we gathered was that people really want to focus on funding projects that will leave a legacy for future generations to the preservation of both the sites and the stories, to educate the public, to prevent a similar tragedy from being repeated, and to continue to involve former internees and their families, Japanese American communities and stakeholders and partners in the development and implementation of the grant program. And also, one of the things that we heard, very consistently through this process was that the National Park Service maintained transparency in the process of, establishing the grant criteria and actually implementing it throughout the life of the program. As far as different project types, most people, they strongly felt that we focused both on educational programs, but also preserving the sites, building structures, the places where these experiences took place, collecting, preserving artifacts, providing historical markers at or near the sites, really focusing on funding projects that collect oral histories, and also providing funding for capital projects to enhance the visitor experience at the sites. As far as the criteria, I think that several people really want to fund projects that will address urgent needs, especially the sites are, continuing to deteriorate at a rapid pace, in terms of funding projects such as oral histories to document those stories while we still have people around that had firsthand experiences from this time period. They also feel that people strongly felt that that these projects achieve something that is long-lasting, that is going to be around for a long time, to leave that legacy that will be there for future generations, and to really effectively capture the stories of former internees. And I think that the other key piece is that they really want to see projects that build partnerships and have a lot of support by the different stakeholders, communities that are involved. So, based on this public participation process, we worked together to, based on the information that we gathered and also following the major provisions of the law, we drafted the program guidelines, project categories, evaluation criteria. We requested additional feedback on these components of the grant program through a second newsletter, and then held two national meetings in Los Angeles. So based on this input, we finalized the grant criteria and guidelines and submitted this in our report to Congress in June of this year. So the most recent thing that we have worked on is that we have prepared our third newsletter, which I handed out to you guys, and we'll also be mailing it out if you're on our mailing list. If not, if you're interested, if you would like additional copies or want to send it out to other people, I have more that you can get. And also, if you are interested in applying for this grant program, once there is funding that has been appropriated, I would encourage you to contact one of the regional contacts. Our information, contact information, is listed on the front of the newsletter. And if you have any questions at all, please feel free to ask us now or at a later time. And I think another key piece is, whether you're interested in applying for this grant program once it is funded, and also if you're interested in any of the other grant programs that we discussed, I would really also encourage you to work with your state historic preservation office or your tribal historic preservation office. Also, the National Trust is a very, very good resource, especially in terms of providing fundraising, organizational development type assistance, and also the local and state preservation organizations that were in your state and your community. So although the National Park Service is working towards the preservation of these sites, we're only one entity that is working towards this, and so it's really important to build relationship with others to preserve these nationally significant sites. And so I think that this conference and this session really affords a great opportunity for you to network with the other organizations and stakeholders that, you know, have been working for the preservation of these sites for many years, and also especially if you're just starting, you know, just definitely make sure to connect with those people, and I think that will help us work stronger towards the preservation of these significant sites. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Kara. So let's see, my...
Is the sign-up list still coming around?
I hope so. Does anybody have that binder, whatever, that clipboard with the yellow paper on it? It's, according to this watch here, it's 10:16, and we'd like to take a little break. Maybe a 14-minute break, and we will resume again at 10:30. And as an incentive, I brought some things from home, Ghirardelli chocolate. For those of you who stick around after the break, we'll be happy to pass these out. See you at 10:30. Yes.
Diane, if time permits, if I could have 3 minutes after the break to wrap up, because...
You do.
Great.
Granted. See you at 10:30. Okay, folks, it's 10:32, and like to start our second half of our workshop today, because we feel that it's really important for us to all be updated about things that are happening at the various confinement sites. And I thank you for signing up on our little clipboard to let us know that you are interested in and giving a shout out to what's happening. So I have 9 individuals who have signed up, and I noticed that there are some overlaps between some folks, and we only have this place until noon, and I know that we need to promptly end at noon. So I'm going to limit all of you to about 5 to 7 minutes, and I'm going to be fairly strict about that. And as you noticed from our panelists, I have these bright colored numbers here, and I will be flashing them in front of you as it gets closer to the 1 minute warning. And usually if I am conducting this meeting in California, I have this obnoxious buzzer that goes off and doesn't turn off until you finish. But this time we'll be more polite because we're guests of Denver, and we'll be using these. So the first person who signed up is Eric Muller. Eric is a Civil Liberties Grant recipient, and we were very happy to work with him on his first publication, and I know he's working on a second publication. He is going to give us an update about the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation, or from the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation. And I also see that Carolyn Takeshita has also signed up to speak representing the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation. So maybe if I could ask Eric to go first and then Carolyn to join him, and then maybe for Carolyn to go immediately right after. Does that work? Oh, great. Eric is going to be our primary speaker. So introducing Eric Muller. Eric, we have this great microphone right here in the middle. And as soon as you take your position up there, I have to time you.
Do it this way. Hi, everybody. I'm Eric Muller from the University of North Carolina School of Law. But most pertinently for today, I'm a board member on the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation. And I've been designated our speaker today, but I did want to note that we've got a couple of people in the room significantly more instrumental to the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation than I. One of them is Carolyn Takeshita, who's one of our executive board members, and the other is Judge Raymond Uno, one of our fundraising chairs, who's up here in the front row. So if I misspeak, I'm sure that Ray or Carolyn will jump in and correct me. We are, I would say, going great guns at the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation. You all undoubtedly know that Heart Mountain was the camp in Wyoming. It was, during the years of its existence, the third largest city in the state. And there has been, over the past, I would say, decade, enormous progress in preserving and acquiring land, and most recently the announcement of a major effort to create an interpretive learning center at the site. So I'll just try to very briefly review for you what it is the foundation has accomplished. We have acquired land that is very well situated to place our interpretive learning center. As was alluded to earlier, there have been efforts to preserve the existing structures in the hospital complex, which have been very successful, and those buildings, which were in danger of blowing away in the Wyoming wind, are now secure, as is the very haunting chimney of the boiler building, which is a very haunting reminder of the place. We created and implemented a walking tour of the facility, which includes a number of kiosks set around a large, roughly oval, paved trail, which details some of the major aspects of the site and its history. Now, just to speed ahead, because I'm sure I'm almost out of time already, we have announced and have begun work on a major fundraising effort to raise a target of $5.5 million so that we can put a state-of-the-art interpretive learning center into the site, which will preserve the memories of those who were interned there, as well as the surrounding communities, and will also obviously serve as a reminder for future generations. We have raised about $1.5 million already. And we are also at the cusp, we think, of some very successful grant applications, which will could bring in quite soon up to close to another $1 million in bricks and mortar grant money to facilitate this. We are projecting a 2009 opening for the Learning Center. Obviously, the things are going to have to depend a bit on the timing and of fundraising efforts, including the fabulous efforts that Gerald has spearheaded on the part of the coalition. So we hope within a few years to be in a position to offer the tens and even hundreds of thousands of visitors that come through the east entrance of Yellowstone National Park each year the opportunity to just take a very small detour just a few miles down the road to look at this site of tremendous national, historical, and cultural importance. So that's a brief report from the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation.
Thank you, Eric. You still have 3 minutes. Maybe you could conclude by telling us how we can find out more about your fundraising efforts, how to donate, all that good stuff.
Thanks, Diane. Boy, you can see I'm not a fundraiser, can't you? So we have there are a number of ways. One way, of course, would be to talk to Judge Uno right here in the room as one of our fundraising chairs.
Maybe he brought some envelopes for us.
We do. I have some information, some materials here. There is our website, which is heartmountain.org. There's a version of it that takes you to some other site that we don't want you going to because it's not a real site. We have a website which has all of our materials. We have materials here. And as I say, we have one of our fundraising chairs here as well. So there are lots and lots of opportunities for you to be involved in bringing this project to fruition.
Thank you. And no dollar amount is too small, right?
Nor too large.
Nor too large. Thank you very much, Eric. Great. Proceeding on, we have, I'm just going down the list, Nancy Yamada representing Topaz. And I also see that Jane Beckwith has signed up to represent Topaz. So if I could ask Nancy to speak first, and then following Nancy, Jane.
Well, I think Jane.
Oh, Jane. Okay. Then Jane, if you could share some information with us about Topaz, and maybe you want to introduce Nancy?
Sure. Nancy, come on up if you'd like to talk. Yeah. My name's Jane Beckwith, and I'm the president of the Topaz Museum Board. We've been doing quite a bit of work, and thanks to all of the people that are up on the stage here today, especially Gerald Yamada's valiant attempts to try to help us complete our plans. and of course Amy Cole. We go back a long way with Amy. We're really very appreciative of the things that they have done, as well as the National Park Service. I think that you know that in just last year we became a National Historic Landmark, and without the National Park Service and Kara and Greg, that wouldn't have ever happened. And it's really brought a lot of awareness to the state of Utah. It was the first time that the governor came to Topaz, any governor since Governor Ma came, to inspect the idea that there was a lot of waste in camp in 1943. So we're happy to have a better connection with John Huntsman. Besides that, we have now purchased 627 acres of the 640 acres of the project. We've gone together with the BLM, and they've included their property as part of the sewer system in the National Historic Landmark area. Probably the biggest thing that's happened is more awareness in the state of Utah. We've probably had more than 400 school children come because their teachers are interested in Topaz, and I think that NHL helped bring that about. We also have purchased a piece of land on Delta's Main Street, and we have worked with a coalition of two other small museums in Delta, as well as Delta City. We have a lot of support from the mayor to build a museum complex. We've gone together with we've made a governing board to oversee this building, and we worked with museum consultants and organizational developers so that we could send out an RFP to architects and exhibit designers, which that happened on about June 10th, and so that's a very exciting thing for us. More exciting than that is that we've had a lot of response from architects calling, wanting to come and visit, and asking for more information. So that architectural plan we'll start working on that on July 25th. That was when the deadline is. In addition to that, it's made our board think a little bit more in maybe technological kind of terms. We are on Highway 6 between San Francisco and Denver, and we do get a lot of traffic, but Topaz is quite far off of that that highway. So we hope that the museum will kind of trip people up. Learning Center will help with school children, and then we're even talking about a student democracy type of area for the state of Utah. So once that occurs, didn't that feel good to just imagine that that's going to be finished soon? I'm pretty excited about it. Anyway, because we're not part of a real trafficked area, we're looking at ways to deliver our message through digitization and helping make it so that teachers from Florida or wherever they want, or of course doesn't have to be teachers, will be able to look at the site. Topaz is a rather neglected and yet at the same time a very treasured place, because of that neglect there's really quite a bit that's still left there. So we want to be able to work again with the National Park Service, get some challenge grants, and make the kiosks and signage out at the site so that it will be a little bit more of a self-guided kind of tour. So it's a pleasure to report all of the good things that have been happening. Nancy, if you'd like to add something, or Steve, do you want to say anything more? Do I have any time?
You have 2 minutes.
Steve, I'll bring the microphone to you. No? Okay.
You may want to mention that the JACL is having their national convention, right, in Salt Lake, and aren't they planning to make their own tour to Topaz?
Be on a Monday, but we'll be open for business. Anybody who wants to come anytime, we'd be happy to accommodate a tour.
Great. Thank you very much, with a minute to spare. Okay, Our next speaker is representing the Friends of Manzanar, Lillian Kawasaki. And I don't know if, Tom, you want to say a few words after, before?
Hi, good morning. I'm Lillian Kawasaki, and as was mentioned, I co-chair the Friends of Manzanar. The Friends was actually established back in 2004, and it coincided with the opening of the Manzanar Interpretive Center, which I hope many of you have had a chance to visit. The Friends is no different, really, than other Friends. We work to support and support the National Park Service, particularly as our prime partner in both programmatically and financially to do the things we need to do. There's, as we know, never enough resources. Our first project was actually the reconstruction of the guard tower. We felt that this was very important for both the visitors' experience of understanding that the tower pointed, you know, the guns pointed in, not out. And also, I think was mentioned, you know, many of these sites, even Manzanar, is remote. And so it also helped to, with the guard tower, to be able, for people from the highway to be able to see the site. Well, the second project is we're ongoing right now is to do is to help the Park Service in the reconstruction of a historic garden. They, you know, demolished the sites, and people forget that people invested not only in buildings but the greenery and trying to enhance the quality of the of life, because they never knew when they were going to get out of camp. So the historic gardens, we believe, are quite important. Our biggest priority, though, is to, and we're in a hurry like so many, because we're losing internees every day, our biggest priority is to do a reconstruction of the barracks. The barracks, people, you know, don't really have a good sense, even when there's foundations, of how families were cramped into these small little spots. The latrine would be part of that demonstration barrack. All the internees talk about, you know, having the shame and all the other things they had to endure, and often it came back to these bathrooms that had no stalls. And again, we think it's very important. We want internees to be able to come to the site, see these barracks, and then we, of course, want people who have not experienced this today and in the future to remember. And I think it's important, when we, Tom can talk about the partnership, that it's very important that the way we do our work, that we do it in partnership. We work closely with the Manzanar Committee. And there is confusion sometimes on the Friends of Manzanar and the Manzanar Committee. The Manzanar Committee has been the one who's done the pilgrimage with Sue Embry for many, many years. We encourage you, next year will be the 40th anniversary of 40th pilgrimage. And so please come out to that site. The other partnership we work in closely also is the Manzanar Historic Association. So among the things I would encourage is to make sure that, I think, as organizations, particularly as we do fundraising, to be clear about what you do versus what another organization might do, and that it's synergy, you are not competing, and you're working and collaborating closely. Another group that I'm working with is not the Friends, but it's actually, there'll be a Manzanar High School reunion in October 14th, 15th, and 16th, and it will probably be the last one. The internees are getting too old to travel, so we're really working hard to get the younger people, the Sanseis, the Yonseis, to come out. So if any of you are interested in the Friends of Manzanar, either in just a collaboration, we'd really love checks, but we also understand that, that part of our role is to reach out and work with others. And also any of you that are interested in coming to the reunion, I think you'll find it's a great experience. And finally, a little other partnership, because I see Tommy Ketta there, is Densho, because probably the most important thing we need to do is to make sure that we capture these oral histories, the stories, because they're you know, we're going to lose them forever. And anyway, I thank that. And with that, this is a tremendous superintendent we've worked with Manzanar, and this is Tom Leatherman.
Thanks, Lillian. How much time do I have, Diane?
I'm giving you lots.
Okay. Well, we're doing a lot at Manzanar, and I think, as Lillian pointed out, it's the partnerships that really have made it possible at Manzanar, and we work closely with the Friends and the Manzanar Committee, and opening the Interpretive Center in 2004, and the continuing restoration work that we're doing on the site. We, you know, is interesting, because before there was an Interpretive Center, everyone said build an Interpretive Center, and now we have an Interpretive Center. We're trying to get people back out onto the site and see it, because You know, interpretive center is great to give information, but the power really is in the site. And so we've been doing a lot of restoration work. We've excavated 6 gardens on the site. We're in the process of excavating the largest garden, the 3-acre Merritt Park at Manzanar, and we're in the middle of that excavation right now, working with Jeff Burton. And then we're also doing other work at various things on the site, clearing the road grid, you know, basically getting it so that people can understand the extent of the camp and understand the living conditions and what was going on there during the war. And as Lillian pointed out, the demonstration block is a big part of that, so people can see the living facilities. We're in the process of completing the restoration of historic mess hall. We hope to have that open by next pilgrimage so that people can go in and see the mess hall. And then hopefully we'll begin the construction of some barracks and some bathroom facilities so that people can see those as well. So partnerships are a big part of what we're doing, working with the Friends and working with other groups. And then we have a big oral history program partnering with Densho. We're going to be, over the next 3 years, sort of ramping up to really try to capture as many as we possibly can. We have 2 people on our staff that work on oral histories, and we're coordinating closely with Densho on going around the country to try to collect these oral histories, not just from people who are at Manzanar, but people who are at all the camps, and also looking at people who possibly are even in the communities or worked on the staff in the camps to get some perspective from them as well, because it's all part of the story. So some of you may not know, I'm going to be moving on from Manzanar. I'm the superintendent now, but I've taken a job somewhere else, and I've really enjoyed my time. But I am going to be continuing to work on the confinement sites legislation issues that I've worked with in the past, and my email address won't change, so those of you who are able to contact me can get me the same way, and I'm going to continue to be engaged, at least through the confinement site stuff, and anything I can do to help along the way, don't hesitate to give me a call. Thanks.
Thank you. You stayed within your 7 minutes, the two of you. And thank you, Tom, for all you've done to promote and educate the general public about the Japanese-American experience. I know Tom Ikeda is in the audience, and I know that he needs to leave soon. And I was wondering, for those of you who don't know what Tom does at Densho, maybe a number of organizations that I've worked with have used Densho and are... we'll never go to anybody else. So I was hoping that maybe, Tom, can you just share with us a 2-minute Reader's Digest version about what Densho does and the groups that you've worked with and what you're planning to do over the next year?
Thanks, Diana. So I'm Tom Ikeda, the executive director of Densho. And as Tom Leatherman mentioned, we're now looking nationally to collect these oral histories. And so we've been working with Manzanar, the Topaz Museum, Minidoka, and we're talking with Heart Mountain as well as some other camps. But we're going to different cities now doing these in-depth oral histories, and then these are now available on our website. So we have about 300 interviews. We also do documents and photographs. So we have all 10... camp newspapers on our website, you know, thanks to funding from the California Civil Liberties. And we also have about another 5,000 to 6,000 photographs. In fact, if you go to the Densho booth, we just got a recent collection of the Amachi camp. That's just fabulous. And so you should look at that. So we're very actively going out doing interviews, collecting photos and documents. And we've now progressed from a Pacific Northwest focus to more of a national. So we're hoping to work with lots of you in the coming years. So thank you.
Thank you.
What is your website?
Oh, it's like densho.org. So www.densho.org.
Thank you very much, Tom. Our next speaker is representing Department of Justice Camp, Diane Sands, from representing Fort Missoula. Maybe could you tell us where it is first and then kind of go on from there?
Hello, I am very glad to be here. I'm Representative Diane Sands. I'm from Missoula, Montana. And Missoula, Montana is between Glacier and Yellowstone Park up there in Montana. We have not had much contact with any of you, but we've been quite busy over the years doing a lot of work on the Department of Justice Fort Missoula detention camp, which held at one point approximately 1,000 Japanese who went through that camp, as well as 1,200 Italians, 123 Japanese Peruvians. We are not an isolated site. There are still hundreds of acres of this site that are in public domain. They're owned either by the county, the city, the university, or a number of nonprofits. I'm the development director for the Fort Missoula Historical Museum, and we own a number of these buildings and sites and have two exhibits relative to this experience. One is in an original barracks, and the other is in our main building. There are over 40 buildings on the Fort Missoula site that are original buildings on site and in very good condition still being used. Everything from the hospital to barracks, guardhouses, administrative buildings, etc. The one that I am most thrilled about and able to tell you about is that last week I finally made a deal with the Forest Service to buy a building which was the post headquarters building during the detention camps. And in that building, which is relatively unchanged because it is also on the National Historic Register already, on the second floor is the courtroom where the enemy alien hearings were held, and Senator Mike Mansfield, then later ambassador to Japan, served on that enemy alien hearing board. That room is basically unchanged from when it was originally used. It's a large open room, and we hope to interpret that room as well as the other sites that we've got. I would say we're sitting on top of really a national treasure in that Missoula is out of the way in some ways, but we are within the main city area. We get 45,000 visitors a year already. We have a very active program in the schools. And one of the schools has regularly done an internment camp evening at Fort Missoula that they do every year. And the kids go out and interview different people or look at our various resources that we have in our historic collection. We have a reenactor who does the camp superintendent. We have quite a bit of archival material of different kinds, whether it's photograph collections or, you know, all the usual things that people collect. And that continues to expand almost every month. Last month we had a woman come in whose mother was the chief secretary for the INS, and she had taken home illegally boxes of materials, particularly regarding the hearings for the Japanese, and she just gave us that material. One of the things that I brought was a photocopy of the list of names of Japanese who were interned at Fort Missoula for any period of time, and some of them were there for a fairly short period of time, as you probably know. I would love it if any of you would look at these names. If there are any of the names that are familiar to you, we would like to know about that. We have a lot about the Italians. Several of the Italians, 1,200 that were there, stayed in the community, so we have a lot of material on them. We have some material on the Japanese. We would really like to hook in with Densho and the other materials that may exist somewhere else so that we can expand our interpretation of that experience at the museum. In the back of the room, I left a brochure about a book that's being reprinted. I got our publications committee to reprint a book that's called An Alien Place, which was done about 10 years ago by one of our journalism professors who researched the detention camp. And that book is about to be reprinted. It's been out of print for about 10 years. Those are some of the things that we're up to doing at Fort Missoula. We would love to be in contact with more of you and to have you come and visit us. The building that I just bought from the Forest Service is costing me only $480,000, and it's in great shape, so I have to go raise the money for that. But we are also on the federal appropriations list for both of our U.S. senators and our congressmen. We have a lot of support and collaboration in the community with both the university, the city, the county. We're a county museum. Two art museums, which are bringing in various exhibits related to the internment. We cooperate and collaborate with them a lot. And we'd like to collaborate with more of you. Plus, come and visit us in Missoula. We're a lovely place, and it rarely gets above 100 degrees.
Thank you, Diane.
That's a big selling point.
We had a question from the audience about, I guess, information on preservation efforts at other DOJ camps. Do you work with them, or are you in contact with any of the other DOJ?
No.
Okay.
But from what I can tell from looking at websites, there isn't much left out there.
Right. Okay. And I'm sure that there are many people here in the audience who would be very interested in learning your fundraising techniques. First, in terms of acquisition, and secondly, in terms of finding the money to acquire those pieces of property. Thank you very much. The next speaker is Ruth Okimoto, who is representing the Poston concentration camp.
Thank you, Diane. I'm going to start a report that starts from 2003, because there was a lot going on before then. For example, a group from Sacramento built some beautiful monument that some of you have seen on in different publications. And also, they once had a Baptist conference on the reservation, people who were former Poston internees. But I'm going to concentrate on 2003 because that was the year that we received funding from the preservation, the trust, National
Trust.
And also we got donations and we were able to collect $15,000 that brought former internees, and we had a 2.5-day workshop at the Blue Water Casino Resort and Casino on the reservation that belongs to the Colorado River Indian Tribes. And so for 2.5 days, we met with the community, CRIT, and I will use the acronym CRIT to stand for Colorado River Indian Tribes. And we had a great time meeting with the CRIT community, and we discussed ways in which we can try to preserve the barrack, that's the one barrack that remains, and that's been donated to our project, and then to discuss how we could go about preserving what remains of Camp 1. I don't know how many of you have been to the reservation. I don't know. Great, two, three. Well, the Poston camp was about 3 miles from the Colorado River. So it was, a lot of people would go fishing, the youngsters. But there were three camps. Camp 1 that was intended for 10,000, Camp 2 for 5,000, Camp 3 for another 5,000. And there was about a mile or so that separated these camps. So in 2003, we tried to get all three camps together to meet with the tribe so that we could try to preserve what was left of Camp 1 Elementary School. It's in pretty good shape until just recently when someone lit a match to the beautiful auditorium that the Japanese internees had built. And so all the beautiful hardwood floor and the wood around the auditorium was destroyed. So just the skeleton of the adobe bricks that the Japanese internees had made by hand remains today. But fortunately, the Akahav Preserve, which is part of, and the Poston site is part of their responsibility, they recently purchased an automatic adobe brick building machine. So they're going to try to rebuild those bricks, and we're hoping that we can reconstruct the auditorium. That may be a humongous task, more than what we're able to do, but we'll try to do something to preserve the auditorium and to bring the one remaining barrack to the site of Camp 1, where the elementary school still stands in dilapidated form, some of them. One building is about ready to collapse, but there's a couple of classrooms that are still in fairly good shape. We also, about a couple years ago, we incorporated into a nonprofit organization, and we are known as the Poston Alliance Company, or Corp, I guess it's called. And we have a website, www.postonalliance.org. And it gives a history of the tribes and of the Japanese American experience. And there should be some photographs on there of our 2003 Restoration Committee workshop. So I think in a nutshell, that's pretty much where we are. We're seeking funding. And at first, we weren't sure that the tribe would allow us to get funding because of the sovereignty issue. But I think that's been resolved. And so we're going to, and besides that, we are a nonprofit organization separate from the tribe. So we will be able to seek funding and we'll go, we need to go after some funding now.
Thank you very much, Ruth. Our next speaker is Frank Kitamoto from the Bainbridge Island World War II Nikkei Memorial.
Thank you. That's all right. I am here to talk about the Bainbridge Island Nikkei World War II Exclusion and Incarceration Memorial. It's called Nidota Nayoni, Let It Not Happen Again. We just recently become included in the boundaries of the National Historic Site for Minidoka, so that's really a plus for us. In February 1942, the FBI swooped down on the island and started arresting 45 families of Japanese descent on the island. 34 people were arrested. 13 of those were sent to justice camps, and a majority of those were sent to Missoula, Montana. My father was one of those. And some went to Santa Fe and some went to Bismarck, South Dakota. Our memorial is at the site where we were removed from the island. Bainbridge Island was the first group in the United States to be removed under Exclusion Order Number 1 by armed U.S. Army guards. And we were sent to Manzanar, California, and then the majority of us later transferred to Minidoka in southeast Idaho. We think we have a real unique opportunity here at our memorial site because we are right next to a major metropolitan area. We're only 7 miles west of Seattle, and it's a possibility that people that come to a big metropolitan area can come to this memorial, and hopefully it'll be a stimulus for them to go to other incarceration sites because obviously they were made so they were not only hard to get to but hard to leave. So. That's one of the things. We're designing it so that it'd be accessible for busloads of kids to come to the area. It's a $6 million project. We've raised $2.6 million up to now. It's going to be built in four phases. Phase one, which is building, acquiring the land, putting the roadways in, putting pathways in, boardwalks and footbridges, and the gateways and a pavilion have already been installed. The next phase is the memorial wall, which is 276 feet long to represent 1 foot for each person that was removed from the island. And the third phase would be an interpretive center about 4,000 square feet and a separate meeting educational building. And the fourth phase would be a pier that represents the dock that we left. All the elements are in place as far as being designed. Our architect is John Paul Jones, who's designed several Native American memorials and is also the chief architect for the Native American Museum at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. You can get more information about our memorial at the Minidoka booth at the community center there in the third floor. We also have a website that's been revised and will be probably up and running in August. It's pyjack.org. That's pretty much it.
Great. Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Emily Momohara from the Friends of Minidoka.
Thank you. I am an artist, and I... can't imagine talking without having you look at some pictures. So bear with me for just 1 second. It's very appropriate that the Friends of Minidoka is talking right after Frank talked about Bainbridge, since we are now connected through the National Park Service. The first thing I want to tell you is that we're a relatively young organization in comparison to some of the organizations that you guys are part of. We were technically founded in 2003, although we started in 2001 when Minidoka was designated as a national monument by President Clinton just before he was out of office. We have several projects. We just had our sixth pilgrimage this year. This is a picture of people putting origami fireflies on a replica of a guard station. Every year we do some kind of participation at the end in our closing ceremony. We co-sponsor this with the Japanese American Citizens League, Seattle and Portland chapters, and we have a huge group of volunteers in Seattle and Oregon and Idaho that actually put together the pilgrimage, and we have buses coming from different cities. So that's one of our very exciting projects. We're also in our third year of doing a civil liberties symposium with the College of Southern Idaho, and that happens 2 days prior to the pilgrimage every year. This year's theme was media and the war and civil liberties. And this is Professor, let me see here, Dana Owen. She teaches at Georgetown University. And she was talking about how new media in this image here is affecting how young people are getting involved in politics and learning about civil liberties violations, YouTube, MySpace, all of these kinds of things. The symposium is designed for educators. So actually K through 12 educators can get extended learning credits from coming. And then we also are have materials for them to take back to their classrooms. So that's our third Civil Liberties Symposium. We are just kicking off our planning and fundraising for an Issei Memorial actually on the site at Minidoka. And this is kind of our general layout. As you know, we are working very closely with the National Park Service, and so we have several phases we need to go through. And we just kicked off our first phase of getting public feedback on the initial design. And if you go to our website, minidoka.org, you can get some more information and give us much needed feedback. We'll also be having some public meetings that have yet to be concretely planned yet. Another project we're working on is finding the original documents for the honor roll and getting the dimensions, exactly where it sat, and reconstructing what the honor roll looked like. We have an architect on our board who has done some beautiful drawings and gone out and done some surveying. So that will be part of Minidoka when it starts to develop as a national park. We are also interested in working with the Nisei Vets in Seattle to do this honor roll. Preservation is also one of our main goals, and like some of the other camps I heard, we're trying to move barracks back as well. And we actually have a Park Service member here. Actually, Patrick is a BSU graduate student, and he has been surveying all over around Minidoka trying to find barracks that we could possibly move back. And so we've been working with some local companies to try to do that as cost efficiently as possible. Partnerships are a huge part of what we do. Recently, there was some legislation passed to expand the boundaries of Minidoka. And here is a map. On the left there is the Bainbridge site, the Eagledale Ferry Dock site. And then on the right is, you can see the small portion here was actually what Minidoka was. And with the help of the Conservation Fund, we've actually been able to acquire a whole farm of a farmer that recently passed away, and his widow wanted to give the Friends of Minidoka the first shot at purchasing that. So the Conservation Fund has really helped us with that. Also, the legislation expands the boundary to include the dump site, so we can learn more about how our families and the internees lived. We're also working closely with Bainbridge. Frank Kitamoto is also on the board of the Friends of Minidoka, so we're building all of these bridges, as well as working with the Park Service. the Park Service also has contracted with Densho, though Tom is already gone, but to do curriculum for the state of Idaho about Minidoka. So we're trying, and the Friends of Minidoka is actually working with the Idaho Board of Education, trying to get that implemented as well. And then we heard earlier about how we're working with the Historic Trust on the CAFO project and trying to do some studies to see really how that would affect Minidoka and try to convince our Jerome County commissioners that it would not be in the best interest of the area to do that. So many partnerships. Community also is really important. When Minidoka was first designated, the local community was not at all excited in Twin Falls, Idaho. So the picture on the left is actually at a local farmer's house. He has a barbecue every year for our pilgrimage, feeds the 250 people that showed up this year. This is the Pocatello, Idaho Taiko performing at the Prescott Ranch. So we're really trying to build bridges. And on the right is some veterans of foreign wars from Wendell, Idaho, with the Seattle Nisei Vets doing the color guard at the pilgrimage. So really trying to make this a general American experience. It's American history, bringing all the constituents together to make Minidoka the national park that it should be. So thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Emily. I noticed that we don't have a representative here from the Tule Lake camp, and so I guess I am one of the people who should say a few words about Tule Lake. I left some information in the back of the room that was given to me from the Tule Lake Committee. They are on their pilgrimage today, and they hold a pilgrimage every other year. And they were one of the very, very fortunate recipients of a SAT grant, a Save America's Treasures grant. It was a grant that was given to them through a member's request. And they need to match that SAT grant by the end of this year. Otherwise, they have the chance of losing it. And it's a large grant. I think it's over $200,000. So they have asked me to provide a letter, and they have enclosed their envelope. So if any of you can help with the Tule Lake efforts, I'm sure that it will be greatly appreciated. And then I know that Gerald wanted to, yes, Tom.
I just want to say something more about Tule Lake.
Oh, good.
I'm a little bit involved with what's going on in Tule Lake because the superintendent at Lava Beds National Monument is also involved with administering that site. And they're having some similar issues that Minidoka had with the community, not necessarily being receptive to the site and the recognition of the site. And I've actually volunteered to go up and actually take one of our former county supervisors up to the Tule Lake area and talk to the community about what this can do and what this can bring to the community and how it's an important part of the history and telling. So I'm going to hopefully be doing that in August before I leave.
That's great. Thank you. And then I note that before we broke for our short break that Gerald wanted to make some concluding comments from his presentation. So, Gerald, if...
Yeah, thank you very much. I wanted to leave you with at least what I perceive to be an optimistic note on the funding for the program. I talked about the legislation on the or the appropriations on the House side being caught up in the offshore drilling issue. The president has made noises about vetoing any appropriation acts that have a high level of pork barrel funding. We were able to get a determination from the House committee that funding for this program is not earmarking and therefore not pork barrel. But again, the amount of money we're talking about is very small, and to the extent there's any problems, it's driven by other considerations. This is a presidential election year, And I think that helps us, mainly because I don't think the Congress wants to adjourn saying that they can't work together and not pass appropriations to run the federal government. So I'm highly optimistic that to the extent that there are any problems either within Congress or with the White House, that those will be resolved, and when the dust settles, that there will be money in this year's Appropriations Act to start funding this program. So I'm not worried about the first year of funding. I'm worried about the second year and the third year. And that's where you folks come in, where you can be very helpful in helping that process. See, you may say, well, geez, we're getting 1.5, we asked for 5. The monies that are being included in the Appropriations Act is really based upon good faith, that there are projects out there that can be funded. And you've heard part of it today, and based upon what I know about various funding, that 1.5 is going to go out the door very, very quickly. The problem is what's in the pipeline. And the National Park Service, to a large extent, is a crucial has a crucial role in that, because the reason we didn't get funding last year is that the Democrats took over the House and the Senate, and they found that the current administration commitment to the current domestic programs were underfunded. So they paid a lot of attention to kind of restoring the funding levels. They're still low, but that's why no new programs were funded last year. And since we were enacted in 06, we were considered a new program and therefore not funded. If we get funding this year, then we become an existing program, and that allows the National Park Service internally to argue for increased funding if they believe that there are good projects out there that deserve to be funded. And that requires the committees to work together, develop those concepts, develop those projects, working with the National Park Service so that we can fill the pipeline and get the full $38 million funding for this program. If people don't do that, if the committees don't do that, we will get first-year funding, but the program will die a very sudden death, because the good faith that the committees are giving us, saying, okay, we'll fund this program, will dissipate. So I frankly, I've told committees this. I've done the easy part, because I've written federal legislation. When I was with EPA, one of my main responsibilities was to work with the Appropriations Committee. So the things I've done in terms of getting the legislation, working with the Appropriations Committee, I mean, I've done that before based upon my prior experience. What you folks have to do is create new ground. And that becomes a lot tougher in terms of reaching consensus and working with community groups. And believe me, I do fundraising for the National Japanese American Memorial Foundation. Don't be afraid to ask for money, because it's out there. And so that shouldn't be the stumbling block.
Well, that's good to know. Thank you very much, Gerald. We wanted to leave enough time to have a question and answer session, and I see that we have 36 minutes to do so. But in case you are going to run off right after we finish, or even before we finish our question and answer session, I wanted to just highlight that we have some
folks in the audience who will also be presenters or moderators this afternoon as well as tomorrow. We have Tom Ikeda with Densho, who will be presenting from 3 o'clock to 5 on collecting, preserving, and sharing the stories of Colorado's Japanese Americans. Then we have Eric Muller, who will also be presenting from 3 to 5 on Betrayal on Trial, Japanese American Treason in World War II, and the 1944 trial of the Shitara sisters. And then we have Ruth tomorrow doing sharing a historic space, African Americans, Native Americans, and Nikkei. And then Eric, I think you're back again. You busy man. Sometime the following day. So I encourage you to attend those workshops as well. And so I have my first question for the panel. It's from one of the participants in the audience. The question is there information to share about any preservation efforts at Crystal City Camp? How can we contact people interested in preservation efforts at DOJ Army facilities like Kuski, Santa Fe, Crystal City, etc.?
I'm not sure that I remember her name, but there is a person from Crystal City that has come to our All Camp Summits in the past, and I'm sure we could figure out who that was. And I believe that from the things that I've participated in, she's been the one other DOJ camp that's been represented. And I believe they were working with the city or the county on some marker program and acquiring a site, and that's pretty much what I recall about that. Diane, do you remember who that was?
Yeah, sure. I think that I've been in contact with, I think his name is William McCormick with the Texas State Historical Commission, and they are interested in, very interested in preserving what remains at the site. I think a lot of it has been redeveloped. But they do have some foundations and other remnants of the site. I think there's a local judge there that's very interested in the preservation of the site. I could look that information up for whoever would like that. If you would like to contact me later, I have that back at the office. I don't have it with me now. And there is another woman that you probably already are in contact with, and I think her name is Miss Yai Ayahara from LA, and I think she was also in Crystal City camp with her family. There are also, I think, some local families in Colorado that have a connection, which I would have to ask my family about. We could get that information to you as well. I think Nancy Araki with JANM has more contact information also related to former attorneys that were at that camp. But I think the Historical Commission is very interested in doing something to help preserve and interpret what remains. So thank you.
Diane, if I could add to that, I understand that there are at least two committees or two groups that are interested in Crystal City. One is a group of local judges, and they have been very active, or not active, but are interested in preserving what is there. And it's because of their interest that Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson signed on as a sponsor of the confinement site legislation. There's another committee that's chaired by a woman in LA who actually puts out a monthly or quarterly newsletter on Crystal City. But those are people that are actually in the site itself. And I have to look up the names. I can get that to Kara as a central point. And maybe the names you already have, but I can confirm that.
Great, thank you.
Can I make one comment about the fundraising issue? And you may have some other words to add to this, Diane, but Kara talked about a number of different federal grant programs, and then with this new program that will be coming online, you cannot match federal money with federal money. So if you get a Save America's Treasures grant, you can't match it with a grant from your new program. So to all of these federal grants, and basically almost every grant out there, you are required to have some other source of outside match. So considering that there are lots of good federal programs available is, of course, the biggest probably source of money out there, but you need to also be thinking about ways to raise money from either individuals or other foundations. And one of the things that Kara and I had talked about prior to this session was that something that we do with our small grants, which you also do have to match, but it's a much lower amount, is help people do fundraising plans or hire a fundraising consultant to help you figure out how much money your group might have the capacity to raise, how you might go about doing that, depending on what state you're in. A consultant, for example, in Utah would be familiar with Utah foundations and folks that are perhaps likely to give to your cause. So those are the sort of things that we can help you figure out. But I think that one of the challenges for many of your groups is that you have been working on particular angles of, you know, whether it's working on a memorial or working on holding your reunion or pilgrimage. But the prospect of raising big match for large grants is a new thing for a lot of people. And, you know, that it's a great opportunity, and making sure that you're ready to do that, as someone mentioned, the Tule Lake Save America's Treasures grant is going to go away if they don't have their match raised by a certain point. And you certainly, you know, don't want to let that happen if you can avoid it. So the sort of planning ahead, using a consultant to help you figure out a path to do that, is something we'd be able to help you with. So.
Okay, we'd now like to open it up to anybody who has any questions or comments. Tom, did you?
I just wanted to plug another session in relation to the Crystal City question. There's a session on Saturday called Media Incarceration Will Work to Assembly Relocation.
Sort of in response to Amy's sort of fundraising issue, my background, my name is Erica G, and my most recent work has been with the Angel Island Immigration Station Foundation, which is in California. And my work has been in education programs, but in some ways Angel Island has been successful in raising restoration money as well as developing interpretive programs. But now I work for an organization called the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience. And it's a relatively new organization, but it's really an international network that is trying to link historic sites and, using their historical legacies, talk about contemporary issues. So I know many of your sites are looking to develop education programming, and our unique funding niche is to be able to help support interpretive programs, and specifically visitor-to-visitor dialogue, where people can use the history of, say, the internment camp sites and think about the issues that are still going on in their community. So the programming opportunities are available to our institutional members, which is a small annual fee, and that could be up to $10,000 for specifically programming. And then the other thing that we have the capability of is, if anyone's interested, is helping to create regional networks. So we have some networks in, for example, Russia that interpret the sites of the Gulag. But it's also possible, if there's interest out there, that we could support networks of the campsites or the DOJ sites, where you can address parallel histories and similar things, and we could provide the support for a coordinator or joint programs and things like that. So the question to all of you is, what are the things that you might need, and how can one of our small organizations, but with a national or international reach, how we might be able to support you as well? So I have membership packets, and come see me afterwards if you're interested.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions or comments? Yes.
Diane Sands from Missoula again. Has anyone developed like a brochure that's like covers all of the camps that could go to museums and other sites? I mean, when someone comes to Missoula and looks at our site, they might be interested in visiting the other sites if there was, in fact, some simple brochure or something that listed all of those. That's one question. And secondly, this goes to Gerald, and maybe it's counter to the strategy you're dealing with the collective trying to get money for the National Park Service grant. But, and some of you have probably done this, but everyone who's in Congress has an appropriate, has a right to try to request appropriations money for their own Senate a whole state or for their congressional seat. And they all start developing that little list, usually January through March of every year. If you have not met with your senators or congressmen or women and tried to get them interested in your site and perhaps approach them, and they all have a form for doing this and a way of doing it, of getting on their individual appropriations list for your site, you might consider doing that. It's not that hard. It's somewhat of a hidden process, however, if you haven't done it before. And it also requires having some other base of support, certainly volunteer support, but everything that all the camps are already doing seem to be more than qualify to be on those appropriations lists.
I think California calls it pork.
We call it pork, too, and we like it.
We're aware of the process in terms of the window opening for members of Congress. And what we did last year and again this year is Congressman Doris Matsui helped us in terms of issuing a Dear Colleague letter to all House members asking to support or sign on to a request to the subcommittee for $5 million for the confinement sites legislation. We were able to get 22 members of the House to sign on. One of the difficulties that, and Congressman Matsui in particular was worried about this, is that if in fact we were successful in getting $5 million, whether it would be credited to her account, and the House has this informal accounting where a member can't get a disproportionately large amount. By getting 22 members to sign on, well, two things. One, by getting more than 15 members to sign on, it was considered to be a programmatic request as opposed to an individual request, and therefore not credited to the individual, to the people that signed on. And secondly, we were able to get the subcommittee to rule that it wasn't earmarking. So both of those, I think, were helpful in getting the subcommittee to add 1.5 to the appropriations. On the Senate side, I was told the Senator Noe doesn't send out Dear Colleague letters. And given his ranking status on the Appropriations Committee, we felt that that was enough. So.
To address the issue on the brochure, there is a National Park Service publication that talks about the various sites. I think it needs to be updated, if I'm not mistaken. Do we ever do that? So it needs to be updated. And I don't think it includes a lot of the Department of Justice sites in it. So I think there is room to develop something like that. There is something that covers most of the camp sites, but I think that that's something that's certainly a potential in the future.
Any other questions or comments? Yes.
Eric mentioned that I was involved in the fundraising, so I ought to tell you a little bit about what we're trying to do. Heart Mountain Foundation is really lucky that they have that foundation because it consists mostly of non-Japanese, and those are people from Wyoming, and they have really done a lot of work, and we're lucky that we have them because they're right in Wyoming. I'm from Utah, but I'm, you know, belong to that Heart Mountain Foundation. On the fundraising part, we have, as our national co-chair, Alan Simpson and Norman Mineta, which really helps because they have contact in Washington, D.C. And then we broke it down, and myself, Eric Mulder, and Shirdi Higuchi are co-chair of this National Foundation fundraising. We had our first fundraising in Salt Lake City, of all places. You know, there aren't very many people from Heart Mountain in Salt Lake City, but we managed to raise over $32,000, you know, because of the contacts we had, and we sent it out. The next fundraiser was in Washington, D.C., with Alan Simpson and Norman Mineta being the co-chair. And the gimmick on that was that Alan Simpson and Mineta are close friends from camp, And so they were able to call all the friends and say, this is a sort of a memoriam, not memoriam, but just to recognize a longtime friendship. We're going to have another fundraiser in L.A. and hopefully San Jose and maybe Seattle for all the people who are there. But the one thing we realize is what you said, and that is we have to have in kind in order to get other money. So we realized that we had to go out to our own Heart Mountain people and our friends to raise the money. And that's the reason that we're going nationally all over. And we've asked for donations from anybody and everybody. Even if you didn't come to Heart Mountain, from other camps, we'll gladly take your money.
Thank you.
And then the thing about, you know, you mentioned that we're, a lot of these camps are not in places where people travel. The reason is that they put us in those places where that's people aren't. So that's, and we have the same problem.
Thank you. Any other questions? Or yes, Aggie. Thank you, Tom.
Diane, at the opening, I'm Aggie Itamoto. I represent the Japanese American Museum of San Jose. Diane, at the opening, you mentioned something about grant writing and writing from the heart and that you have some other tips. I've been holding my breath ever since you said that because realizing the tighter budgets and I'm just getting tired of some of those Dear Jane letters. So if you could give us like three cardinal tips.
Okay. Actually, these are pretty basic, commonsensical things that I have jotted down. There are actually 15 of them, but they're very fast, and most of you do this in your life anyway. The first one is to know your story and know it well. And that's what I mean by having people who are the most intimate tell the story, because they can make that story unique and make it different, and funders listen to that, and don't think that funders do not. We can hear it on the paper, we can hear it in your voices, we can hear your passion. So that's something that I hope you never forget, whether you're putting together a short letter, you're putting together a 15-page proposal, or you're going to talk to corporate or governmental funders. Next thing is, what do you want to do with your story? And this is what really Amy was focusing on, and what we at the California Cultural and Historical Endowment really emphasize is to have a plan. If you don't have a plan, it's hard to build and raise more money. You need to have a plan, and you need to have a plan that you can stick with. So even though all of us would like $50 million for our respective confinement sites, that probably will not happen. So you have to think about what you can realistically do with the funding base or the community that you are working with. So having a plan will help develop that. And the National Trust is one of the few national organizations, nonprofit organizations, that actually help with planning. You can always go to the Foundation Center website. Their main headquarters is in New York, but they have regional sites all around the nation. And you could just go online and really tap into them and see which foundations. And there are a lot of regional and national ones that are encouraging planning now more so than they did before, because they realize that capital grants usually don't work and don't last without a plan. And then the third thing is, can your story or your project be divided into phases? I've heard that some of you shared that you are working in phases. That's something that funders also look for, because of the tightening of the budget, they sometimes cannot fund your entire project, but they like it. And so they want to fund one portion of it. So if you could break out your project into phases and something that can be easily identifiable for a funder, that's probably the most beneficial thing that you can do. Identifying resources. You should not only identify your financial resources, but identify your technical resources. Identify people who can serve as your political resources. You should keep as broad of a net as possible. You need as many friends as you can get to fulfill your project. And I suggest that you count no one out. Even if it is some young high school kid down the street, that person has the ability more than probably anyone in this room to create a MySpace page and can reach out to an audience that we don't know about. And that type of technology has brought in a lot of money to nonprofits. So that's something that I would suggest you do, is really reach behind, go beyond the box, and really cast out your net as far as you can.
In terms of the application, and this may seem really stupid for me to say, but you need to read it. And by me saying this is we at the Civil Liberties Program at the Endowment receive a number of proposals per year, and I would say a good 30% of the people who submit proposals to us do not read the application. You're not answering the question. You're telling us about the mission of your organization, where your budget is going. You're telling us about the objectives of your organization, where you should be talking about how you're going to specifically plan out your capital project. So reading the application and answering the question that is asked is really important. Don't think that longer answers equal the best answers. That is untrue. There are many funders that I've talked to, especially with large foundations, that say if you can't say it in a page, you can't say it at all. And I think that holds true for a lot of the more, the larger foundations, the multi-million dollar foundations who get proposals from every part of the world. And so they want to make sure that they can clearly understand your proposal as fast as they can within the first paragraph, and then you explain right after that. So even though you may have 5 pages to tell your story, if you could do it in one, I bet you that a lot of people would favor that. Check your budget. Be realistic. Don't pad it. It's really obvious to many funders if they notice that a budget is padded. I know that many funders also decide that they're not going to fund the whole thing and they're going to only fund a part of it, and that's why I suggest you proportion your project out so that a funder can make a determination or a line about what part they can and cannot fund. Be very truthful in your answers. I know that many of us like to boast about what we have done as organizations and as individuals and as communities, but be truthful in your answers. And the reason I say this is because funders talk to other funders. It is a very small world when you're talking about funders. Whenever we get proposals in at the endowment, and I see that they have gotten a planning grant from the National Trust, that's the first person I call. I call the trust to see what kind of planning grant they have given and how successful they were. So funders do talk to other funders, whether it be government, whether it be private. We do talk to one another because our resources are limited. We want to make sure that we offer the grants to the organizations that are most appropriate or that will have the ability to succeed. Keep in touch with your funders. That's something that a lot of people forget. They get the money, they are happy, and we never see them again. You could always use more money for your project. Things come up that are unexpected. You should let funders know what's going on, not only at reporting time, but just a simple email or pictures of what your project is beginning to develop or how your project is developing or who you are adding to your list. Those things don't go unnoticed. So I wouldn't suggest that when you apply for funding that it's a one-shot deal. It should be a continuous relationship because we want to stay as your partner and we want to see you succeed. Otherwise, you wouldn't have gotten the grant. Things that you should probably do for homework is check to see who they have funded before. That's very easy to do. You could go onto GuideStar. You could go onto their websites to see what kind of level of funding they have given and to the types of grants that have been given out. So you are not wasting your time in applying for a grant that may only give to the state of Hawaii or just the western region or just the east coast. So it's really important that you do your thorough research before you even bother to apply. Don't wait until the last hour to do your or to write your application. And I know this is hard because everyone is very busy, and everyone has 10,000 things on their plate that they need to get done yesterday. But it's really obvious. It's very evident when we see proposals that were put together at the last hour and then taken to the airport to make sure it was postmarked at a certain time. we see spelling errors, we see blanks where other people were supposed to fill in, but they forgot to fill in because it was done at the last moment. Usually we see applications where about five people are working on different parts, and when we read it as a whole, there are all kinds of missing spaces. So really try to figure out, go from the deadline date backwards and try to figure out if you could at least leave yourself 2 days prior to the deadline to make sure that you're having someone else read your proposal. And be realistic. Funders don't expect you to change the world, but they do expect you to know about your project and know it well and be able to tell them, look, this is what we could produce. Deadlines, as I mentioned before, Tule Lake is on a very short leash to match a deadline. You should know what those deadlines are when you are applying for a grant, because one thing you never want to do is you never, ever want to get a grant and have to turn it down, because if you need to go back to that source again, they are going to remember that you had to give your grant back, or they're going to remember that you weren't able to fulfill certain parts of your grant that you had promised you were going to do. So really know and be really realistic to see if you can meet that deadline. And matches, at the endowment, we have very specific ways you can meet your match. It's a one-to-one match for many, but we also allow for a reduction in the match, a percentage. We also define what is considered an in-kind contribution. It could be labor, it could be supplies, it could be the donation of a lease, it could be a donation of a property. But every organization, if they have a match, usually will clearly define how you need to meet it. And you need to figure out whether you can do that or not. It's really hard to meet a one-to-one cash match, especially if the match needs to be confirmed. You could have a ton of pledges out there, but there are some organizations that say pledges aren't good enough. It has to be a confirmed pledge, i.e. in the bank. Otherwise, it won't be considered as part of your match. So it's really important to know those details before you even think about applying, because your resources are also very limited. And then finally, on Gerald's points, don't be afraid to ask for money. Know your constituency. There could be a white knight or a beautiful princess in your crowd that you don't know about and who doesn't know your story. So don't be afraid to always keep a brochure in your purse or an envelope in your pocket, and tell the world about what you're doing. I know that Amy and I have participated in the team and training program. It's for leukemia lymphoma, where we have to go raise a lot of money and then we run this bloody marathon. And we have to go around and raise a certain amount of money, but by just hitting up local grocery stores or friends or even high school students, just a little bit of money really counts. And I really think that not being afraid to ask, you're not doing it for yourself. You're doing it for your particular passion and for your particular cause. So don't be afraid to let people know what your interests are. There are many friends, and you should probably know who your friends are. The National Trust is your friend. They're a good friend. There are people that you need to go to say, look it, I need some help to raise some money, and this is my goal. Or you have your local SHPOs, your State Historic Preservation Offices. They probably don't have the kind of resources that you need, but they can at least point you in the right direction, because they work with historic sites on a daily basis, and they have the know-it-all, the technical assistance to really help you move your project along. There are the certified local government folks, there are your state preservation officers, and there are also organizations that may not be likely partners to you that can come and be a part of your project. You just need to let people know. And the best way to do that is to be outside, out there in your community. So that's my 15-point, probably commonsensical fundraising tips. Any other questions, comments? How about from the panel?
Those were very good. You should make that into a PowerPoint slide. I'll just make one or two fundraising comments that are things that
just stick in my craw, and every time I have to make a comment about fundraising, I'll say these same things. So one of them is that, as Diane already said, funders have a long memory. So if you screw up a grant with us, the chance that someone in my office, since my boss has worked for us for 25 years, will remember you and that you did a bad job is very good. And for example, there was a group that we gave a grant to, which of course I will not tell you who that is, and we gave them $10,000 and they had to match it, and they overmatched it, so they had a $30,000 project. And they turned in a piece of paper as their product, and it had a hand-drawn sketch on it of this building that they were trying to save. And so we said, so we're going to need an explanation of how you spent our money. This could not have cost $30,000. And a very angry person called me back and said, well, you don't understand. We held countless meetings. So the joke in my office is that if you turn in a bad grant application or a bad grant report, it must be because you spent it on countless meetings, which is not something that we paid you $30,000 to do. So it is really important to retain a good relationship with your funders. And I'll tell you, one of the nicest things that happens to us is when we get thank you notes from people who we've given money to, who tell us, your money helped us do this great thing, and here's how it turned out. We're so grateful. And, you know, I save those because they're nice. And it's great to know how, what the effect is of your grant making. And, you know, not just we spent your money on 22 nails, but, you know, we're so happy that we were able to save this place that was so important to us. So.
Can I share one experience that I had in terms of fundraising? I was involved with the fundraising for the National Japanese American Memorial in Washington, D.C. It ultimately cost a little over $14 million. But when we started out for the project, we brought in these professional fundraisers. And what they said is what you have to do, and they had this pyramid approach. I can't remember if the pyramid was inverted or in a regular pyramid. But anyway, what they said is what you have to do is you have to go out and find a $1 million donor, and you have to find two $500,000 donors. And once you have that, you keep going down the scale. And then the last group that you approach is the community. That doesn't work. And it surely didn't work for the Memorial Foundation because we couldn't find that $1 million donor. And we had people that were capable of writing large checks. And they would say, well, why should I write you a large check when there's no assurance that this is going to go forward? So I just may be, you know, writing you a large check and losing it. Well, at some point, in the first 2 years of the project, it looked like it was going to tank, that we weren't going to have the money, that we weren't going to be able to raise enough to go forward. And what we did was we inverted the pyramid, and we went out to the community first. And we were surprised that about $2 million came in the door. And once we have that core commitment from the community, then we could go to the larger donors and say, the community supports this, we have community support, and so the folks that were able to write larger checks felt confident that this project would happen. And so that's how we were able to get larger donors to support the project. And I think that experience translates to our community, and especially for projects that we've been talking about this morning, that don't expect if you have a $3 million project that you're going to go out there and find one single donor that's going to write you $1 million or a $3 million check. I think key to it is community support. That you've got a committee that's enthusiastic, committed, and willing to see this through. And if you can show that, then I think you're going to be able to get more people to write more checks and larger checks.
Thank you.
One last thing before I forget is, remember to not limit yourself to geographical boundaries. I think I mentioned at the beginning of this session that the state of California was the home to over two-thirds of those who were incarcerated in the camps. And that also translates to a lot of Californians who currently live in California but who were incarcerated in the camps that you are trying to preserve. And you should always kind of look to the Civil Liberties Public Education Program website to see what their criteria is for the next year to see if there is any slots that may be available to you. They don't have a lot of money, but they have enough money to help you maybe create a very specific project that can help you link to bigger monies or to establish you as an organization that is credible to be able to link on to other monies. For example, I remember in our first year at the Civil Liberties Program, we gave a very small grant to the Manzanar, the National Park Service at Manzanar, and they created these very simple identification cards with pictures of those Japanese Americans who were incarcerated at the camp. And that was a huge hit, and that kind of led on to other things happening, and hopefully it led on to other funding. But just simple examples like that are things that the Civil Liberties Program always looks to see if there are any kind of new and innovative projects, especially if it tells the story of those who were actually incarcerated. So we are now at 12 sharp. And I see our room coordinator giving me the nod. Thank you very much for attending our session. And we look forward to seeing you at the other places.